Century in room 453B. No, excuse me, the hearing room is 343. On March 31st, 1989, we'll be conducting a public hearing on Senate Bills 512 and 521. We will be conducting public hearings and work sessions on the following: House Bill 2428, Senate Bills 356, 406, 562, and a work session on Senate Bill 505. Take a about 3 minutes, I hope.
Okay.
505, if you recall, was the one that had to do with training, cross training for corrections officers, mental health division people, and Jack and Diane Luther have worked out some amendments, which I think give much more specificity to what we plan to do. If you remember, we deleted all the parts of the bill of the BSP, Police Training Standards Board, and all we have left is the cross training. The bill goes to Ways and Means, so I would.
That's correct. Check. In your folder, you will find a set of amendments that were drafted by Ms. Luther, as well as a hand and gross version. She's basically rewritten the language that the committee decided to retain. The committee asked us to bring the language back for inspection, and we've done that.
It's section one, the hand and gross bill.
There should have.
Yes.
You also find an LC draft that have the amendments in amendment form.
Yes, Madam Chair, I will move the dash one amendments to Senate Bill 505.
Senator Hill has moved that Senate Bill 505 be amended with the LC dash one amendments dated 329. Are there objections?
No, I did just a question.
Yes?
Yeah. I know that the Ways and Means is going to ultimately take care of this, but do we have any idea how much we're talking about in the way of dollars?
Yes, $103,000.
Is that the number that I recall from last time?
Yes, and that is the number that has been presented to Ways and Means that's associated with this effort. Further discussion? You can write a little $103,000 by that, maybe.
Maybe.
Objections to adopting the amendment? Hearing none, so ordered. Chair would move that we send Senate Bill 505 to Ways and Means.
As amended?
As amended, yes. With a due pass recommendation. Discussion? If you call the roll, please. Thank you.
Brockman?
Aye.
Senator Brensky?
Aye.
Hill?
Aye.
Aye.
Senator Springer? Chair Cohen?
Aye. Motion carried. Thank you. Now, we will change the order beyond what's published here and take up a continuation of the juvenile detention bills. There are people who have to leave, and this is a continuation of our public hearing work session. We have a variety of amendments to be offered. We'll take Senate Bills 356, 406, and 562. And Jack, I think we'll start with sign-up sheets on 356.
Senate Bill 356 is the community detention bill. There is one amendment that I've drafted at the request of the Juvenile Services Commission. You'll find that in your file. And it, in effect, states that a child may be held up to 30 days if a program plan has been filed and approved by the Juvenile Services Commission. If not, the present limits of 8 days still apply.
Okay, we have signed up to, I'm looking at 317. I need to find the right one.
Yeah.
Yeah, but that's Friday, 3:17. Here we are, 3:31. Tom English? I keep my old ones up. No, I just want to find out who we've missed and when they start complaining that they haven't been heard. This is carryover from people who didn't get a chance to sign up on the...
Madam Chairman, members of the committee, my name's Tom English with the Oregon Council on Crime and Delinquency. The council's a 28-year-old citizen-based organization in Portland that has been active in the area of juvenile and adult corrections and is very interested in this bill. The bill is written, our legislative committee does oppose, and I'd like to tell you why. It was in 1979 that the first time that we as a state decided to use detention in a punitive manner, and we did it in a very limited way. At that time, you may remember that we were very, very concerned with the high commitment rates to our state training school. The Children's Services Division had come to the legislature with the proposal of actually building a third state training school. The legislature, in its wisdom, said no and did a couple of things. They created the Community Juvenile Services Act, and they allowed the use of up to 8 days detention post-adjudicatively in the effort to see if we couldn't do something with those juveniles in their community rather than send them to the state training school. And the emphasis at that time was up to 8 days. And the idea would be for asking communities to deal with kids with increased behavioral problems, that they needed some kind of detention backup to stabilize their behavior, then bring them out. The proposals in Senate Bill 356 really move beyond that kind of a consideration to a very strict punitive standard. And for the first time, I think we see just desserts being introduced into the juvenile justice system where we've never had it before. The juvenile justice system and the juvenile court is based upon a real positive view of an optimistic view of human development, that there's a possibility of, with proper and limited interventions in juveniles' lives, that we can make some changes and turn around. And we've developed over the years a commitment to balancing that approach and saying we have to protect the community, we have to hold kids accountable for the behavior, and we must build some skills. And we must, so that those kids can come back into their community as positive adults. We're taking people out of their school program, out of their work activity if they have it, for up to 60 days. I think we're creating something very different in our communities than detention centers. It seems like we're creating more like minor or small McLaren's and Hillcrest. And our detention centers have never been staffed for that. They've never been programmed for that. They were never built for that. If, in fact, juveniles' behavior requires that kind of intervention, our suggestion that they ought to really seek commitment to the state training schools for the appropriate treatment at the state level where other resources are available. That's our testimony. I haven't looked at the amendment. I just heard what was proposed.
Let me get you a copy.
It would, it's not a new amendment. In 1979 and 1981, 30 days was proposed again. Our position at that time was in opposition to 30 days on the basis of, if you're using that for the limited purposes of stabilizing behavior, if you can't do it in up to 80 days, you sure as heck are not going to do it in 30 days. But we will take a look at this amendment. I'm going to have to go back and see what we do.
Okay. Other questions?
Madam Chair, I have a question about the space that you have available for this. Is that a significant problem or not?
We're going to hear from people who talk about space, and I'm not sure that Tom is the best one to talk to respond to space.
Chairman's correct.
And I would like to say that I actually want to, I didn't realize that Corey was signed up further down the list, and I didn't see her here when I walked in a hurry, so I do want to call Corey Streisinger next from the governor's office. And thanks, Tom.
Yes,
you happen to be first on, yes,
ma'am.
Okay, Jim, Senator Hill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Tom, when you mention 60 days, we're talking about a Class A felony. I have to get your philosophy straight now about someone who commits really the most serious crimes. And I know it's graduated, and I you say it has not been based on just desserts, but given, do you think that the severity of the offense should be taken into account in some way?
Absolutely, Madam Chairman, Senator Hill. But in the juvenile justice system, we've looked at the best interest of the child, and we do in that process, in the hearing process, in the determination of what kinds of things that child's going to have to do, they do take that into the community protection issue and the accountability issue into effect, and I think they're treated a lot differently than a status offender or a runaway. The policy question is, I think, if we're going to use apply just desserts in the juvenile justice system, then I think we ought to have trial by jury and admit these children to bail.
Any other questions of Tom? Thank you. Corey.
I have Tom.
Sure.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Corey Streisinger, and I'm Governor Goldschmidt's legal counsel. I'm here today to express the governor's support for Senate Bill 356, dealing with the community detention of juveniles. Currently, a juvenile judge has several options for dealing with a juvenile found to be within the jurisdiction of the court on account of conduct which would be criminal if performed by an adult. If the court finds it to be in the juvenile's best interest, and that is still the standard, the juvenile's best interest, the juvenile may be placed in the custody of the Children's Services Division for placement at one of the state's training schools, McLaren or Hillcrest, for example. The judge may also keep the juvenile in the community and order detention in a community facility, and such community placements are obviously preferable in many cases. But under current law, under ORS 419.507 sub 4, our ability to use community detention is seriously restricted. Under that statute, community detention is limited to a maximum of 8 days in any case, regardless of the juvenile's past history, the nature of the offense, or the circumstances of the case. I understand that Oregon is the only state to place such tight restrictions on community detention. When Governor Goldschmidt asked the state's presiding judges what could be done to improve the effectiveness of our juvenile court system, many of them responded by criticizing this 8-day limit on community detention. They told us that for some juvenile offenders, 8 days was simply an inadequate period. It would be regarded by the juvenile as a joke or a slap on the wrist. Yet the judge's only other option under current law is to send the juvenile to McLaren or another state training school, even though commitment to a training school might be unnecessary. Senate Bill 356 would provide juveniles judges with an intermediate sanction for dealing with these juveniles. It would permit detention for a longer period in the community. It's our hope that this bill would reduce the number of commitments to the state training schools while retaining our ability to require a meaningful period of detention for those juveniles whose conduct merits it. I might add that this is similar to the approach the governor has taken in connection with adult corrections, where he has recommended a range of intermediate sanctions between hard prison cells and pure probationary sanctions. You will see that Senate Bill 356 in its current draft would permit differing periods of detention depending on the nature of the conduct that brought the juvenile under the court's jurisdiction. I believe Mr. English mentioned this. After consulting with a number of key players, including Don Welch, who is with me here today, we have concluded there seems to be widespread agreement that an across-the-board limit of 30 days would be more appropriate, and we will recommend such an amendment to the bill. I'd like to mention for a moment the issue of resources, which I believe Senator Shoemaker raised. There is certainly a concern about the availability of resources at the community level, and we have no objection to the proposal being advanced by the Juvenile Services Commission that would require a county to have a plan in place detailing the types of resources that it would have available. We are also working with the Children's Services Division on proposals for additional flexibility in detention space, either at McLaren or in the communities. And I'd like to just take a moment to describe the nature of those discussions. The governor had proposed in his budget, and whether or not the funds are going to be there is still an open question, but the governor had proposed a flexible pool of money that could be used either for additional space at McLaren or to house juvenile offenders in the community. His focus in requesting that money was additional space to be provided for dealing with gang-involved youth, which is an increasingly disturbing population and a growing population here in Oregon, I might add.
What numbers are you talking about, Corey?
Currently, we are we have opened an additional, I believe, 40 gang beds at McLaren.
No, I mean in terms of the...
Of funding?
No, of the gang activity. You say that it's an increasingly, it's a growing problem.
The gang strike force, Madam Chair, Senator Hill, has identified approximately 900 individuals in the Portland metropolitan area who they identify as gang involved. That is a very substantial increase from the numbers that we saw only a year ago, where I believe the number was closer to 200 or 300. It is unfortunately a problem that they see as growing currently. That does not mean that each of those 900 people is, well, first of all, but I should add that somewhere between a third and a half of them are estimated to be juveniles. It does not mean that all of them are committing crimes of a nature that would subject them to commitment at the state training school, but unfortunately, as the population grows, so too does the amount of serious criminal activity. The gang prosecution unit in Multnomah County is seeing increasing caseloads. I don't have the precise numbers in front of me, but they predict, in terms of very serious juvenile commitments, 70 to 80 within a fairly short number of amount of time. We would prefer, however, not to simply request additional space at McLaren to house these juveniles. Many of these juveniles are ones whom community placements are currently refusing to accept. We would like to be able to develop community placements that would accept them, but another alternative is to divert some of the juveniles who are currently sent to McLaren to community placements, and we believe this bill is one way of letting us do that. I'd be pleased to answer any questions the committee may have.
The question?
This is an area that someone else is going to deal with, and I can withdraw the question. I'm interested in what goes on in these facilities, whether at McLaren there still is an attempt to reform the behavior of the juvenile through a teaching training program, and I assume that that's the case. And in a 30-day detention, would any of that go on, or is it merely just a like a sentence?
Madam Chair, Senator Shoemaker, I think I'd like to ask Don Welch to comment on that, if I could.
Okay.
If he was willing to.
I am. Don Welch, Clackamas County Juvenile Court. Senator, the two parts to the question. At one point, at least in Multnomah County, there was a program called the Probation Support Weekend, where there was structured response to those who were doing their time. Typically, it's done in two-day segments for many of the kids who went in so that they wouldn't miss school. And for a substantial period of time, Multnomah County operated that kind of a program, and those of the kids who were from Clackamas County participated. With that exception, so far as I know, the eight-day period has not been a structured time, and I believe that that probation support weekend is gone by the boards for fiscal reasons. There are those of us, I'm among those, who say that the amendment the governor is suggesting to this bill, which would reduce it to 30 days, is appropriate for several reasons, but that an extension beyond 8 days to 30 should necessarily involve structured time. And therefore, it's in the contemplation of some of us, at least, that the only way this 30 days should be available is in those institutions which clearly can provide the kids something other than dead time.
Thank you.
So we have some amendments that I think
we'll deal with that.
That problem. The Juvenile Services Commission will be, or I don't know who will get some amendments.
Yes.
I've requested those amendments as well.
That amendment is in your file now.
Okay.
Yeah, I haven't, been looking.
Yeah. We have looked for those, Jack, does it say beyond 8 days it has to be?
Beyond 8 days, a plan has to be filed and accepted by the Juvenile Services Commission. Then you're entitled to hold the child up to 30 days. If not, you're stuck with eight.
At least that's the amendment that we have
currently
drafted.
Good, thanks.
Why don't we just go ahead, Don, with your comments and testimony, if you'd like to offer any
specific
questions.
Thank you. In a broader sense, I think it's important that we do away with the laundry list approach to this penalty provision. And Corey has identified for you why judges feel they need more than 8 days. We actually arrived at the 8 days rather fortuitously. I think it was a fair description by those who were involved to say they started with 30 days, thought they'd only get half of that, asked for 15, indeed got half of that, which is 7.5. So I think it was a, I won't say capricious, but it was a peculiar way that we got to the 7 days. People clearly had in mind 30 days. There's no magic in 30. 7 seems awfully short, 60 seems terribly long. But primarily, it's my, in terms of the laundry list, I think it departs substantially from the basic concepts and precepts of the juvenile court system. We should be dealing with the behavior as it exists at the time the judge is considering the particular sanction, more than the crime that brought the child to the attention of the court. You hear the old parents' patriae of a guy who's been in the system a long time, and it pops out when you see something like this. I would remind you that the juvenile code in general terms says that any child who comes within the reach of the juvenile court for a law violation can be placed on probation for 5 years. So it would at least be consistent with the underlying philosophy to abandon the idea of equating back to the original charge the time the person could spend. Additionally, 60 days strikes me as unreasonable. Anybody who needs that much sanction should be having a more rational long-term plan. 7 days is clearly too short. Other than that, I'm in accord with what you've heard so far.
Any other questions? Senator Springer.
How long have we had 8 days, Don?
I'd have to go look, but I can.
Has it been 79?
Thank you.
Okay. Whoever wants to answer this, my sense is the local dollars available for juvenile are limited. Your county commissioners aren't printing the money. We're not printing the money here. The dollars are limited. I think we agree that there are not enough alternatives in the community to keep to give kids help they need early on to avoid detention, period. And I'll bet you dollars to donuts, as soon as we allow them to throw kids in the can locally longer, that's where all your money's going to go. And you're not going to have any options in the community. You're just going to be locking up more kids in the community. Now tell me why that is not going to happen.
Well, I hope several reasons. One is because people are, in the final analysis, interested in change, and interested in producing change in the behavior, and interested in plans that relate to the needs of a child. I would seriously doubt that you would find that they would start throwing them in, because I would submit you don't find large numbers of people being thrown in for a maximum of 8 days today. Therefore, I would suggest to you that a substantial number of people who would be eligible for the present statute are not exposed to it because people legitimately, wisely, consider other alternatives which are as effective or more effective. As a small example, not a scientific one, in the training school reduction budget, which is in operation in Clackamas County, we budgeted several thousand dollars for detention under the theory that a kid who doesn't go to the training school is probably going to blow out more rapidly than someone else out of a local placement. As those kids have been kept in the community and placed at child care centers or on probation and have needed detention, we have significantly underutilized that fund. In fact, this year so far, as I know, I spent less than $100 out of a $3,000 fund. Therefore, I have no reason to think because we are underutilizing 8 days, we are going to overutilize 30 days on a case-by-case basis.
Then why do you need 30 days?
I'm suggesting to you that the number of cases is not going to increase. It may be that in the particular cases, people who are now being exposed to an 8 day might be exposed to more than 8 days. I'm simply saying we're not going to say, oh, we got 30 days, let's open the floodgates. There may be more who are brought in because they would consider 8 days useless, so the number might increase. But to say that that's going to produce a wholesale use of detention, both for philosophical and fiscal reasons, I think is anticipating something that's not likely.
Well, that's great for Clackamas County. I wish I had the same assurance for the other 35 counties in the state, and I don't know if we're going to hear from the representatives of the counties.
We are. We've got a long list of locals coming online here.
Thank you, Don.
Any other questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thanks. Thank you. Larry Oglesby from Salem. Comes the parade. Larry.
Madam Chairperson, members of the committee, I'm here with Paul Snyder from AOC and Howard Klink from Multnomah County, we have similar interests in this bill. And I'm speaking both on behalf of Marion County, I'm the director of the Marion County Juvenile Department, and also attempt to portray the consensus, I think, of the juvenile directors who have met on these issues yesterday. First, just a quick overview in terms of the juvenile director's position on this. Generally, there's a belief that there is not a need for more than 8 days, the current amount that's being used. The testimony you just heard about 8 days being the exception rather than the rule, I think, is generally true. Secondly, that there is not adequate bed space for additional days if that were allowed and were utilized. And third, if there were more than 8 days, then standards, as has already been talked about, would be needed, because we're talking about a completely different type of use of detention if you're having kids in for a longer period of time. What you're dealing with here basically is a philosophical question of locking kids up versus community programs that allow them to be stabilized in the community with sanctions, and one of those important sanctions is detention backup, and that's what we have now, kids who are in community programs or who may be in the home, and those kids who violate the terms and conditions of their probation are brought back before the court, and that's an appropriate use of detention. That's how it's used currently. It's used basically more as a short-term jolt, I guess I would describe it, rather than an adult-style sentence, as you would see in the adult system. The goal really is avoiding placement at the training schools, and that includes stabilization in the communities. One of the fallacies, I think, is that you send a child off to the training school and that solves the problem. Well, that's not the case. That child comes back into the community. The better able we are to maintain that child into the community, and detention is an important aspect of that, the more effectively we can deal with these children. And the other question is the question of bed space. The handout that you've just received is a summary of a poll that Alan Young, the director of Yamhill County Juvenile Department, took regarding the various juvenile facilities in the state, the total beds and the average daily population. One point I would make on that is the ADP is quite different from the maximum, and even though that's the average, it's not uncommon for these facilities to be at their maximum limit. I get calls on the weekend, we are maximum number of kids, can we release, administratively release a child? So we are in a situation where we run up against the maximum utilization. If you were to have a 30-day program without standard or with standards, basically you're talking about a program that involves education and various other components that require additional staff and other additional costs. The counties simply cannot afford that. The facility that we run in Marion County involves five other counties, Lynn, Benton, Polk, Yamhill, and Lincoln. Lincoln is about to open their own facility, and the result of that plus increasing costs is the other counties are having an extremely difficult time buying into that regional plan now with the money that's involved there. So further increasing the need for detention beds and for operating costs would be extreme burden on those counties. The amendment that was submitted earlier of the standards we would support, that was the position of the juvenile directors, that if you're going to have a longer period of time, you want to have standards so that it's not dead time, as Mr. Welch testified.
Thanks. Other questions of Larry before we go on, or do we want to hear from you? Well, let's hear from Larry.
Just a question about his last comment, Madam Chair. Are you saying that you do support the bill as proposed to be amended, or only that you believe it's better that way than the original way?
The belief of the juvenile directors is there's not a need for more than 8 days. If there is going to be a bill that allows more than 8 days, standards are necessary.
Madam Chair?
Senator Brinsky.
Are you speaking for all the counties or just the three of you?
I am portraying the position of the juvenile directors who met yesterday. That was not each and every juvenile director. That was a pretty good share of the counties. So it was, I couldn't say it for each and every county.
Do you know if the juvenile directors had consulted generally with their county commissioners before they came up here?
I would be, Senator, I would be surprised if they had all done that, yes.
Madam Chair. Senator Grinsky, for the record, I'm Paul Snyder, representing Association of Oregon Counties, and I can describe to you the position taken by the association on this bill when it's my turn. Well, for the record, it's just simply we don't have a position on the substance of the bill, but we want to avoid the fiscal and organizational impacts that it involves.
So you're hearing from the directors as to the substance, the counties as to fiscal impact.
So you wouldn't mind it if the money was coming from the state to build more juvenile facilities, probably?
Madam Chairperson, Senator Grinsky, I personally don't think there's a need. I think there are juvenile directors who would be in favor of a longer stays. There's not certainly not unanimity on that question.
All right. Thank you for explaining that.
Thanks. Howard, before you go ahead, I want to, someone left a file dealing with Senate Bill 562 with some numbers, Juvenile Justice Budget and Policy Review, downstairs. Whoever needs it, you might need it later. It's okay. I just, you can come, we'll get it at the end. Thank you.
Phone numbers in there?
No, wasn't anything very interesting.
I already checked that out,
Senator Stryker. Okay. Howard, please.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Howard Klink, Public Affairs Director for the Multnomah County Department of Human Services, which includes the Juvenile Justice Division, and the information that I'm presenting today reflects position taken both by our county commissioners and the Juvenile Division Director. Essentially, I don't have much to add to what's already
and then we'll get Sandy.
I'll be quite brief. Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you. I've been asked by the Oregon District Attorneys Association and by Mike Schrunk of my office to come down and offer our support on this bill. I've been interested to listen to the exchange by the members this afternoon. I would indicate that the menu approach, as it's been termed, was the original thought of the governor's office and the district attorney's office. I think the idea was to mirror the way that the adult penalties were set up. We understand the committee's concern and those testifying before the committee, and we support the idea of a maximum of 30 days. And I guess in my very brief comments, what I'd like to say is to underscore that we're talking about a maximum, not a minimum.
And some of us have been around a long, long, long time, longer than you, and we understand how maximums have been used.
Understood, Madam Chair. There are, I can say from personal experience, that of course 8 days is not always imposed, and as counsel, David said, sometimes it is a couple of weekends. I can also say from my personal experience in talking with judges and referees from the bench that they would much prefer to have a longer period of time at the local level, longer than 8 days. When I spoke with Judge Harrell a couple of months ago, it was he would like to have 60 days.
I know, but it's also juvenile judges don't have bill either or run the program.
I understood. All I'm trying to tell you, Madam Chair.
Problem. And this is really what we're up against here. We have judges and DAs whose funding and who are on a certain end of all of this, and then you have people who deal with the sort of results of all of that, and
Mr. Schrunk be willing to give up part of his budget to help fund the additional cost in Multnomah County.
There's a real conflict in terms of budget here because you're seeing people on both sides. The beginning of the side of the process and the end, and both have valid concerns from their point of view, I think. I think that's what we're facing here, Senator Shoemaker, for you.
Well, Madam Chair, we acknowledge that obviously there is no funding package that went along with this bill, and it was a shock to us when I was last before this committee to hear some of the projections of $250,000, half a million dollars. In all candor, I do not anticipate that it would be used to that extent. And I suppose what this committee should realize is the general understaffing of juvenile detention as it exists now. That's a problem in Multnomah County, and it's a problem elsewhere, and I think it's a problem that has to be addressed through the fiscal legislation. But as a remedy, the judges and the DAs put to this committee that as a sanction, a maximum of 30 days is appropriate for those intermediate kids that need not at this point be committed to the state system, and yet the 8-day sanction is inappropriate. As Corey said in her testimony to the committee, it's a joke. It's a slap on the wrist. And so I urge the committee to, in looking at this bill, to carefully try and find the avenues through...
Okay.
Yes?
I want to interrupt you again. The 8 days is a slap on the wrist, but they're only serving 4.5 on average. I don't understand that.
Well, I'm not sure, Madam Chair, that I can unravel it for you. In many cases, what may happen is that they're looking at the amount of time to which a child is ordered to serve by the court. Sometimes a child will have been in detention prior to the adjudication for a period of time, and you will have a court then giving an order.
What is the limit of the period of time pre-detention right now?
There is no limit on that period of time, except that by uniform trial court rule, as we discussed last time, that within 28 days after the filing of a petition, the petition must be adjudicated.
So they use the pretrial as the punishment? Is that what we're doing
It
now?
Can be. You can be given credit for time served. And now how that equates on the 4-day average, Madam Chair, I'm not privy. I do not know. I think that the 4-day average typically comes out to a couple of weekends is what they're talking about when you're talking actual time served as a sanction at the back end when the judge actually orders something. That's what you end up with.
The sanction is you've got to behave in the community.
For those children who are put on probation, the probation can be called a sanction, and to be put back out in the community on your best behavior might be called a sanction. I think what the District Attorney's Association and the judges are looking for is a more realistic sanction for those who cannot and will not follow the laws out in the community.
At the risk, thank you, Madam Chair, the risk of beating this to death, you know, one of the things we've learned in the with the overcrowding problem is that this is a criminal justice system, and all parts of it affect the other, and it really would help us when we're trying to do things here if you all would look at, and I understand how the judges, and I know there's not a agreement among the different branches, but you have to look at the whole system, and I wish that you all, when you have these kinds of issues, you have to talk to everybody that's involved in the entire system. Because now it comes to us, it's a kind of a mixed, confusing picture. And we all want to help solve it. But you just can't say this is what we want to do without taking into consideration what's going to happen to the rest of the system. And we all have to, if we're going to solve the problems of a system, we're going to have to look at it that way. And I have to say, I expect, especially leadership, from the prosecutors and the judges and looking at it that way.
Madam Chair, Senator Hill.
We've got one whole series of package of bills, and I'm really going to cut this off now. We've got work session. We're going to get you back if you want to come on a work session on these bills. Sandy.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, my name is Sandy Flicker, and I'm here representing the Oregon Association of Residential Youth Care Centers. And unfortunately, I'm probably going to muddy up the water even more. But you do need to hear from providers. Youth care centers are residential community programs that take care of juvenile delinquent kids. We are the community-based portion of juvenile corrections. Our kids are kids that don't go to McLaren. They're one step away from McLaren. Detention is a huge issue for our programs. It's one of our priorities and has been since the downsizing of McLaren. In terms of the two bills that are before you, I have a similar position as the counties do, and that is we have no position on substance, but we do need to talk to you about impact in terms of fiscal impact and impact on our programs. When this state decided to downsize McLaren, part of the package was supposed to be backup detention for community programs. That piece never got funded. It showed up in the Children's Services Division budget at about $1.3 million this session, and it got taken out in the governor's recommended budget. Our programs cannot function, cannot take felony kids and misdemeanor kids that we have, serious offenders, and keep them in our programs without backup detention. We have to have that, because the only alternative is if we don't have that, then we have to send them to McLaren. We are strongly urging this legislature to look at that issue, to look at funding back at McLaren for community programs, the state taking the responsibility for those kids that are committed to Children's Services Division and placed in our program. We know there's a fiscal impact on counties, and we get denied detention because there's no money at the county level. That doesn't solve our problem. Our problem is a kid who's out of control, who needs to have some place to go on a very temporary basis. We don't need more than 8 days. We never use more than 8 days. That we use a half a day, 2 days. We need to remove a child from the program very temporarily, get them under control, make sure the rest of the kids don't get out of control because of that child, then bring them back into the program and continue on with their treatment. But unless we have that, we cannot accept serious offenders and we can't keep them in our program. So that's the issue that we need to bring to you as providers, as the ones who are charged with taking care of these juvenile delinquents in the community, and it's a very serious problem. And it needs to be addressed by this legislature, and we have made appeals to the Ways and Means Committee through the CSD budget process, but we also feel that even though you're not the fiscal committee, when you talk about detention and increasing access, you're increasing use of then, and you're increasing the fiscal impact, and then that continues to shut us out. That continues to make it give us less access to detention. We already have a survey here from our members asking them how many, you know, are you denied access? Yes. How many more days of detention could you use? And from just the little bit of calculation that I did, I came up to 170 more days a year. And this isn't even all the programs that responded. So
170 days a year is equivalent to 4 days of 4 kids at 30 days.
That's right.
If you talk about days, numbers of days.
Okay. Let me just add one thing. Our proposal, in talking about money, our proposal to Ways and Means, for your information, has been that out of the $1.2 million that is still in the crime package for transition services, we are asking for $600,000 of that for backup detention for community programs for the biennium. There is money that is targeted to these kids. It's targeted for kids coming out of the institution. We believe you can use that on the front end, keep kids from going in the institution if you will provide for secure backup detention for community programs. So that is our proposal to Ways and Means. Thank you. I'd be glad to respond to any questions.
Are there questions? Thanks very much.
Thanks.
Okay, folks, we're in the usual bind and back up here. Let's take a quick 562. This is the pre-detention. We had people comment last time, the pre-adjudication detention. That is another juvenile one. We had partial testimony on it last time. There are 6 people signed up quickly, and I asked you to come and get your input on 562 as well. And we did have Corey explain it last time. We had Muriel Goldman, David Fuchs, Len Monks was here, a whole number of people. Tom and Larry, you guys want to come up now? And Larry Oglesby. And
Madam Chair.
Yes.
You will find in your file a sheet that I prepared entitled Proposed Amendments. What I've done is taken listed, hopefully, all of the amendments that were proposed last time, as well as the folks that are proposing them for your convenience.
Okay. Tom, you want to go first, and then we'll get through quickly, just explain the amendments that you're supporting, and we'll hopefully refrain from debate by the chair herself, among other members. Thank you.
For the record, Madam Chairman, my name is Tom English, representing the Oregon Council on Crime and Delinquency. Our official position on the bill as written is we're opposed. Having said that, we would like to support it. if proper amendments come about. I think we owe a debt of gratitude to Judge Harrell for cleaning up a statute that desperately needed it. The two amendments that we would like to see is take the language at line 28, no means less restrictive, and move it up to where it lies 10. So it's an overarching consideration. So it would be no means less restrictive of the child's liberty and those following kinds of things, to repeat that language. That was a very important policy the legislature made previously. The other one that we'd like to see is on page 2 of the bill at line 44, and taking out of that the language that says of a child who resides in another state, and take out the language or another county, to keep it consistent with current legislation. If they could do those two things, we'd love to support this measure.
Thank you. Larry?
Madam Chairperson, members of the committee, I guess I would say ditto. Those same two concerns were the concerns of the directors. If those were cleaned up, I think the belief is that it cleans it up and makes it a lot easier and a lot more understandable in terms of when to detain children pre-adjudication.
Thank you. Howard?
Finally, and just real briefly, I would echo the comments that have been made so far. There is a small concern about fiscal impact with this bill as well. Again, it's impossible to predict how this kind of decision-making, given the discretionary nature of it, will impact the system. We did do a look at the number of offenders, charged offenders, who are in the categories that are not in current law and added in this bill, and there were roughly 300 of those last year going through our system. Given a real conservative fiscal analysis, if there were a third of those that were detained, given our average length of stay, there could be an impact of about $40,000 to $50,000 a year on the county detention unit. Could be, again, underlined, because it was clearly stated in the testimony given last time that the intention of this bill is not to add more offenders to the system, but because it opens the door in a couple of ways, necessary ways, that the current statute has kept closed, there could be a fiscal impact on county detention operations.
And I guess at some point I'd like a review from you about what is the average pre-detention stay in your facilities in Multnomah County. We don't need it now, but
okay.
Would you like to have that?
Good.
Thanks very much. Let's hear quickly from Paul Snyder and Pat Callahan, who signed up on this bill. And then we... Paul, go ahead first.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm Paul Snyder, representing Association of Oregon Counties, and we agree with the last three witnesses.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Pat Callahan from the District Attorney's Office and in Multnomah County, and on behalf of the Oregon District Attorney's Association, I won't take any time because I think I testified in favor of this last time. And all I want to indicate is that I think it's important that the language as it's written be retained on the first page regarding no means less restrictive. And the reason for that is Judge Harrell, under his Section 2, lines 23 through 31, has laid out for the legislature the scheme where a child who may very well make their next court appearance can be detained if their physical behavior endangers the physical welfare of the child or another person or endangers the community. It is a community safety section. And that is addressed towards those few kids who are the really dangerous kids. They may very well make their court appearances. They may also very well intimidate witnesses, threaten other people.
Okay, now, Pat, I'm going to stop
yes.
you and suggest that you look over the amendments, and we'll have a work session, and we'd invite you to talk about specifics then about your opposition, because I think we're going to have a up or down choice on that particular portion of the amendments as offered.
Very good. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much. We are, and I, for the record, we do have written testimony that was submitted by Len Monkson on Senate Bill 356 in favor, and that was entered last time, and it is in our folders. Okay, let's move to quickly, what do we have here? No, unless you want to do something, 406, pass on amendments. This is not a work session, no one signed up on 406.
Robert was here too. Okay.
Okay, we have Senate Bill 521, Ted Kulongowski is here. Director of Department of Bejeru.
Madam Chairperson, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Theodore Kulongowski. I am the Director of the Department of Insurance and Finance. The reason I'm here today is to testify regards Senate Bill 521. I'll be very brief. I am here opposing the measure and the concept in 521, and I want to explain why just very briefly. Obviously, that the Unfair Claim Settlement Practices Act is a administrative regulatory method of handling disputes between consumers and their insured or their agents on matters regarding a claim. My specific objection is that I think that the current system should be retained. But if it's the committee's desire that there should be a private cause of action, I am even more strongly opposed to the proposal in 521 that would give us 90 days and then tell the claimant to go over, and if it isn't resolved in that 90-day period, then they could institute a private cause of action. My objection to that is one, my experience both as an attorney in a similar process as that, and secondly, my experience now as the insurance commissioner in dealing with the carriers and trying to get settlements of these matters. My objection is that I can guarantee you that if you pass the bill, it's going to cost the administrative side of this just a great deal of time and money, and we will not be able to resolve the claims. To be very blunt, that if the law is if this measure is passed, the carriers will not respond to us, and what will happen is they'll wait the 90 days and then they'll just handle it in a legal procedure. The reason is that the similar procedure like this is with the Bureau of Labor on certain unfair employment practices, where in fact the parties basically use the administrative agency as the investigatory arm to gather facts, and then at the end of the period, the matter becomes a public record, and then they take it and go make their decision whether they want to go to court or not. I don't like that process, and I don't think that that's the way that we should be handling the resolution of these type complaints. That's all I have.
Thank you very much. Thanks for coming. Appreciate it. Sorry you had to wait around so long.
No.
Senator Springer.
Ted, I'm a little confused. The fiscal impact statement says that apparently they talked to somebody in your shop, and it anticipates an increased workload, three compliance officers, et cetera. But that seems at odds with what you just told us, that if we do this, people are going to bypass you, and that's going to be it.
Representative Springer, when the fiscal impact, Senator Springer, excuse me, when the fiscal impact was prepared, we always have an optimum view that, in fact, that the legislation is going to work. That is with the assumption that what would happen is that we would be able to do that particular function. What I'm telling you, that as a practical matter, I don't believe that they would ever be able to get the cooperation from the carriers and to provide the information that's needed to be able to settle them.
Also on the fiscal impact, have you asked for any more compliance officers in the past, since you've been on watch over at
Yes, and we have gotten some more because primarily because of 323. We had, I think we picked up about, all total in the department, about 15 new people, and some of them did go into the compliance. We have actually gotten, we have now three investigators as an example.
Let me, if I may, it's my understanding from research last session on this, we asked legislative research, and they contacted, this is a report back in May of 1987, and they contacted DIF, and we understand that apparently in a substantial period of time, I guess between 1973 and 87, there was only one fine was imposed by the state for violation of this section of the law?
No, I don't believe that's true. I think that what that was referring to is that during that period of time, there was only one contested case hearing under that section. There have been fines imposed and sanctions taken against carriers. If I'm not mistaken,
could you give us kind of a summary over the past, even in the past couple of years since you've been there?
Well, yes, if I could, in the broadest terms, the department, the insurance division receives this last year approximately 6,000 written complaints and probably received somewhere in the neighborhood of 40,000 phone complaints. We do not treat the phone complaints as formal complaints because if the person wants to pursue it, we send them a complaint form and they send it back. And so some of the 6,000 probably started out initially as one of the 40,000 phone calls. Those 6,000 written complaints, basically 2,800 of them approximately are matters relating to a claim. Of those 2,800 claims, complaints rather, if they're broken down as to which ones are actually valid and which ones are not, for a variety of reasons, there are some of them are withdrawn, some of them about 18% of those I think are found to be invalid, in fact that there was not a violation. The remaining cases is a large block of them. As an example, there are a number of them that we have no jurisdiction over. ERISA, healthcare complaints, they have a carrier actually that's domiciled in another state, which we think can be more appropriately handled by the regulatory authority in another state. There are a number of them, interestingly enough, that fall into a category where it's really just a dispute as to a matter of law or fact that should be resolved in some adjudicative process, such as one party's contending the light was red and the other one says it was green. We don't make the decision on that. There are a number of complaints in which the parties just factually disagree, and we are placed in a position of who do we believe. The remaining complaints, which would be valid, which would constitute probably about 30% of them, they are adjusted, and the other ones, there are some sanctions taken against them, against the carrier or the agent. What I will tell you, though, is a philosophy, and it more reflects my view of trying to accommodate the concerns of the consumers, is that, in fact, that sometimes things occur that if the carriers voluntarily agree to correct the wrong, that, in fact, that I treat that as a settlement of that case. As an example, we had one just recently last year in which a carrier was out of South Dakota was offering a universal life policy, which the policy form was submitted. There was nothing wrong with that, but the way they were marketing it, actually they were marketing it in a fashion that the consumer was purchasing something that they didn't understand what they were purchasing. We contacted the carrier. There had been a change in management. We sat down with the carrier, and they voluntarily agreed to do a number of steps, which the ultimate result was that they informed every one of their policyholders in this state, explained the policy, and gave them a right to a refund plus interest. The carrier has paid out over $1 million in this last year to their policyholders. Some of them liked the product after it was explained to them and said, I understood that that's what I was buying, and I kept it. So I did not, in that situation, if you ask me whether I could have under the Unfair Claims Settlement Act, when the complaints come in, taken an action against the carrier, the answer is yes. I did not find them. The reason was that when I sat down with them, they were obviously very concerned about their name, about their reputation, and they have done everything we've asked them to do. There are other extenuating circumstances where, as I said, it was a change in management. The South Dakota Insurance Commissioner, I believe, has taken action against the agent that actually came up with the marketing concept. So I thought that was a resolution. There are a number of them done that way. And I think that that is a fair settlement because I think that it basically makes the consumer whole.
Well, for every person who complains, there may be 10 others out there who don't even know who you are, for better or for worse, and are getting gouged. And I would appreciate knowing if you can not provide us today, but hopefully before our work session, just since you've been there, how many fines have been imposed or how many formal sanctions have been imposed. I understand that folks have attempted to contact Tom Irwin, your consumer advocate, to ask for a breakdown on complaints against companies so that they can use that in terms of making an informed decision about what kind of insurance to go with, and that you folks are not releasing that information.
Senator Springer, if I could, prior to September the 27th, 1987, if you read the statutes, you will find out that all of that information that you were requesting was confidential and was not subject to release. The statute is very clear. As you may recall, I came before the Business and Consumer Affairs Committee in the last time in the legislature and drafted up an amendment to allow the publishing of a statistical report. That has been in the process. I hope you understand that this is not one of these 10-page documents, but it's probably going to be 8 to 10 inches high because it's going to have a breakdown of every carrier in the state. We are of which there are over 1,500 of them certified, with certificates of authority in the state.
Hopefully not every one of them is going to merit mention in your report.
No, every one of them has a sheet, but what you get is the statistical report, and what you have been, and a number of people have been requesting, are the specific data in the files, which is still confidential under that statute, and it cannot be released. So that information that you, in the broadest terms, as the number of complaints against each carrier and the disposition of them, is going to be, and the disposition of those complaints will be made available.
Thank you.
Madam Chair. Senator Grinsky.
I was reading while you were testifying, and if I duplicate something, I apologize ahead of time, but as I understand it, the way it works right now, the worst thing that can happen to an insurance company is that they would be fined, and the fine would go into the general fund, assuming a violation is shown under the Unfair Claim Settlement Practices Act. And the standard, I assume, for determining that would be through administrative procedures.
That's right. It's correct? An APA contested case hearing, but they're, really, it isn't the fine that they're worried about the most, because the ultimate administrative action is the revocation.